Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Cult I Left Behind podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Briggs, and I'm here to tell you my stories of growing up in the IBLP cult, which you might know from the Duggar family.
And I'm your other host, Kyle Briggs. I am Amanda's husband, and I have not heard most of these stories before, so stay tuned and we'll all get traumatized together. All right, welcome back to the next episode. What do you have for us tonight, Amanda?
Well, I'm drinking tonight.
Oh, you seemed pretty adamant about getting a drink tonight, so.
No, so I was talking with my doctor recently, and I've been, like, religious about not drinking because the medication bottles or the instructions said don't drink. So I brought that up with my doctor, and she was like, no, it's fine. That's for people who don't know how to control themselves with alcohol. You can have a drink from time to time. You'll be fine. I was like, fuck. There are so many episodes I really could have used to drink. Mm-hmm. We did them totally non-alcoholic on my part. But tonight, we're going to talk about discipline in the cult.
Okay, so what does discipline in the cult mean?
Well, that's why I'm drinking. It was a lot of basically just abuse under the guise of training up a child in the way he should go, so when he is old, he will not depart from it. I think that's in Proverbs. The topics that I think we need to go over, I'm going to list them out so that I don't forget. So if you want to take notes, I think we need to talk about blanket training, something called three times training. We need to talk about the pearls. Those are people. We need to talk about the switch and other beating implements. Glue sticks, spirit breaking, and then instant obedience and some of my thoughts on the pitfalls of that concept.
Okay. Some of those I have no idea where you're even going to go with that, so I am curious about that.
Okay, let's start with blanket training. We've had questions about this. Mm-hmm. I think a listener named Samantha sent in a question about this a long time ago, and I've been waiting to do this episode to just kind of bring it all together. So blanket training is this idea that I think was established by Michael and Debbie Pearl in their book To Train Up a Child, which I believe was published in 1994. So this, I was old enough that this training wasn't utilized on me in the same way it was with a baby, but Chris used it for some of my younger siblings. So blanket training, you start it at like 6 months old. And the purpose is to break the child's rebellious spirit preemptively. So the way it would work is you'd put a blanket down and you'd put some of the child's favorite things just off the blanket, like toys, sparkly stuff, whatever would get their interest. And then you tell your little baby to stay on the blanket because your baby's a dog. You know, you're training your puppy. Although people are nicer to their puppies, I think, than IBLP people were to their own children. And then if the child, you know, your six-month-old, decides to crawl off the blanket toward their toys, you hit them. And you could use your hand, or you could use something like a glue stick. You could hit your child with a glue stick, your six-month-old, because you told them to stay on the blanket and they crawled off of it toward their toys.
Naturally. I mean, it's a baby. It's 6 months old. Of course, yes. It's going to go after the shiny
but
thing.
But that's its rebellious spirit, Kyle, because you told it to stay on the blanket.
I mean, can a six-month-old even understand that? Like, stay.
And you would start with small increments, like 5 minutes, with the goal of, you know, building up to however long you wanted your kid to be silent on a blanket, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours.
So how long they would really do this for? Like, that's a long time for a 6-month-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's very important to break their spirit.
I guess. That's a young commitment. That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's abuse. Exercise.
Yeah.
That's abuse. And that was normal. Like, Chris went to Michael's and got glue sticks when this came out at conferences, and she bought the book. She and Rick read the book and they used the book. The book also advocated for toilet training infants, if I recall correctly.
It just sounds like a very young age. I mean, it sounds horrible to begin with, but like, that sounds premature.
Mm-hmm. But I forget their reasoning for why to toilet train an infant. Maybe because you could skip diapers, and diapers are expensive. And when you have 18 kids.
That would make sense.
Yeah. So that was a whole thing. And the pearls, you can look up their evil book to train up a child. And their goal was to break the rebellious spirit and develop a child who instantly obeys any authority, any command they're given. Think about the problems there. Like,
well, it was brainwashing from a young age.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it completely undermines the concept of critical thinking and free will. Yeah. And individuality and choice. And I think about that a lot sometimes as I think about the different social struggles I've had in my life. So areas where I really excelled, the military, where hierarchy and responding quickly to commands, that in that environment, that's rewarded. Of course, I did very well. Where I've struggled, it's usually more of a safety thing. Like, it didn't happen to me often, but there was one time in the military and several times in my career before the military where I worked for very unsafe people. And I'm talking like sexual harassment type of unsafe people. And being conditioned from a young age to just blindly follow people because they are, quote, in a position of authority, it's very dangerous, as it turns out. And it made protecting myself and making decisions in the aftermath of what happened very difficult, because there was a lot of confusion. Like, well, this was an authority figure, and I had choice. Cool. That's a great idea that no one ever told me, you know, and I think it also was very detrimental in my previous marriage that was, you know, founded on religious ideology that taught my ex-husband was my authority.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, that created complications as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it put you in a place to be very susceptible to, you know, just abuse in general. Yes.
You're conditioned to it from a young age. Like,
and you didn't have, it made you feel, or it sounds like it made you feel like you didn't have like the confidence to stand up for yourself, because you were just like, it's authority, do what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even if you thought it was wrong, it was still authority, do what they say.
Well, because, you know, as a kid, I'm a critical thinker, and I would use my brain, and then I'd get beaten for using my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not just the conditioning of you must blindly obey people who proclaim that they're in a position of authority over you. It's also you will be physically injured if you speak up, if you defend yourself, if you critically assess what is happening and verbalize that. How dare you, mm-hmm. you piece of trash. So I think it's very unsafe. I'm curious if other folks who grew up in IBLP and ETI were force-fed instant obedience, Pearl style. And if you've had similar struggles with just figuring out how to navigate life as a person with agency and autonomy and confidence and critical thinking, I would say that's been a significant learning curve for me in adulthood, in young adulthood, that I've done a lot of therapy actually to work through. But yeah, so that's blanket training. It's some bullshit. Do not do it. Good Lord. And then we have this concept called three times training. And I got to tell you, when I heard Chris come back from the conference where Lori Voller had taught three times training, it was like, for me, the straw that broke the camel's back. We were living in Wisconsin, so I know I was at least 11 years old. I don't remember how soon it was after we moved there, but I was the absolute youngest I could have been was 11. And this was the moment where I decided the whole thing was bullshit. Like IBLP was bullshit. So Chris comes back and we're all in the living room and she's telling Rick about just this amazing session and Lori Voller, I call her like that bitch, who, was just teaching them so much about raising godly children and, you know, who fear God and like everything else on the planet, but you know, who cares about that? And she was like, yeah, she does this thing called three times training with her children. And Kyle, have I ever told you about this?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Okay. Have fun with this. This is going to be a great little journey for all of us to go on together. So Lori, in that training session, used the example of her son leaving his bike out in the yard. And she told him to put it, or he was supposed to put it away, or she'd already told him or something. The bike wasn't supposed to be in the yard. Mm-hmm. So she called him over and she was like, son. And I that sticks with me because she didn't use his name. She called him son. Son, put your bike away. So he went and put his bike away. And then he came back to her and she was like, son, go put your bike back out in the yard. So he had to put it back in the yard. And then he came back to her. Son, go put your bike away. And so he did. And then he came back. Son, go put your bike. For three times. This is why it's called three times training. She made him do and undo mm-hmm. what she had told him to do. And then he never left his bike out again. And I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like that. I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to like think back to what I felt in my body in that moment. I think it was just like, I think I was annoyed and frustrated. It seemed like it was a very humiliating thing to do. And I'm sure there were times I didn't do what I was told growing up, but a lot of times I had a lot on my plate. And if something slipped, it usually wasn't willfulness. It was probably I legitimately forgot because I was, you know, giving my little sister a bath and cooking dinner for the family and, if, I don't know, making the grocery shopping list. Mm-hmm. I would say a lot of times for me, if something slipped, it wasn't because I, like, was lazy and willful and rebellious. It was because I was overworked and tired and stuff slipped. Right. But I thought it was just so like, it was such a shaming response to make your kid go back and forth three times. And here, oh, fun fact, the military did that.
Really?
Yeah. The military did that. So officer training is not the same as enlisted training. In the enlisted training, they're like trying to break you down so they can build you back up. In officer training, there's a bit of that, but it's more like trying to build your confidence as a leader, as a decision maker, as a tactical thinker. But the first couple weeks of officer training school, they are like breaking you down a bit. So this one time they put us all in an auditorium and someone high and mighty there, I forget who, But they were scary at the time because you don't know anything. You don't know that a major isn't really that big of a deal. You think they are, but like they're really not. Sorry, all the majors I know. And so there's like a major screaming at you like, you're all failures. You have no sense of urgency. You don't move fast enough. So they put us all in this auditorium and they made us like run in formation, like doing it all properly, filing in and out of the right seats at the right time in the right order from one auditorium to the next, like multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had thought at the time, oh my God, they're doing Lori Voller's three times training. And it had the same effect on me as an adult, even though I was like super America and wanted to be there. I was like, this is the dumbest shit. Like, just tell us you want us to move faster. And then it turns out that that's just a thing they do to everyone. And we weren't like actually that slow and awful. It was just that that's part of the ritual of like, you all suck. Why aren't you better? You know, you're failing America. The Constitution will fall because of you. So when I say the military reinforced a lot of shit from the cult, like, this is what I'm talking about.
So that it did have like the same effect when you... When that happened in the military, you were like, this is stupid.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, I was a little scared because they were trying to scare us. And, you know, there's a lot. You don't realize how hard it is to get kicked out of training while you're in training. That's something you find out later. Right. But like the constant threat looming over you is that you're going to get kicked out of training because you suck and you will have failed, you know, your countrymen. So... Yeah, I was a little, like, worried about it. But, yeah, it just kind of annoyed me then, too. Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting concept. I'm trying to, like...
Well, isn't it crazy that the military uses that to break you down? Well, and they're, like, doing that with little kids in the cult? Like, yeah,
like
we're going to wage psychological warfare on you so that you feel like you are nothing. Do you feel like nothing yet? Good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm trying to decipher that in my head because, like, you know, when I was growing up, like, playing football or something, it's like you run a play, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't good. Run it again. It wasn't good. Run it again. Like, you just do it over and over
but and
over.
But you're learning again. A skill and right. It's practice.
Yeah.
And
but you guys never got, like, feedback on that. It was just like, you're going to do this over and over and over
again. Yeah, because I'm breaking your spirit. Yeah.
Okay.
So I feel like in sports, it's to, like, build you up, make you better, refine the skill, hone it. In the context of the cult, it was like, break you down, make you small, break your spirit.
Yeah, it was just more of a punishment than a learning.
Yeah, it wasn't exercise. Constructive. It was shame.
Yeah.
It was just shaming.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... humiliation, public humiliation. So
were you subjected to that? Like, I know you were older at that point. Like, did she or did your biological
parents,
like,
try I forgot to do the that? Best part of the story.
Oh.
Being me, of course I didn't sit there quietly in the living room listening to this. I think I announced to the whole room that it was stupid, and I forget what else, but I think I definitely called it stupid, and maybe, oh, I'm sure I got in trouble, but I remember, like, leaving the room and, like...
storming out?
Yeah, probably. Most of what I got in trouble for growing up was talking back. Because I just, if it was stupid, I had to say it was stupid. Like, someone needed to. And no one else was. So, you know, you gotta call it out, Kyle.
I believe that. I can see that happening.
I was always told it was disrespectful. And I don't think I was necessarily trying to be like, I'm disrespecting you, parents. It was more just like, it would just break my brain. The stuff Rick and Chris thought was like a good idea. Like, it would break my brain because it was so dumb. And I would just say something to the effect of how dumb it was. And that, you know, that didn't generally go very well.
Well, it sounds like you just didn't like irrational, in this case, discipline. Like,
yes, but blind followership, Kyle. Blind. Get in line. Stay on your blanket.
Well, that's also irrational.
So the pearls, they're very controversial. They also promoted the switch, which was a, how shall I describe this? Disciplinary implement for parents to use on their children. All the way down to, you know, infants. So,
like where I come from, a switch is like usually something like flexible, like a stick or something like that. Like a.
This was, yep. So it had a black rubber handle that was stiff, and then a clear, flexible shaft with a rubber tip on it.
Is that kind of like one of those things like a jockey uses on a horse? Like a, I don't know what those are called.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. A crop?
Yes.
This came to a point and had a rubber tip.
Like a hard tip?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
To that hurt.
Sounds, yeah, that sounds like it would hurt.
Yeah. And it was pretty long because, you know, it had to like flex enough to snap on you. And you were supposed to hit the back of the child's thighs.
Okay.
Did Chris keep it to the back of the child's thighs? What's your guess, Kyle?
Probably not. It's probably just wherever it landed.
So, yeah.
Angrily swing.
Pretty sure I caught it in the face.
Ooh, that.
Definitely the back, but back of the legs, front of the abdomen, kind of wherever. Now, when I was younger, she could pin us, and she would pin us. And I really hope in whatever comes after this life, there's like a special process for people like Chris. She liked to do bare bottom spankings, is what she called it. And she continued to do that to me even after knowing I had been sexually assaulted. She would remove clothing and pin me down to beat me.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you had to go through that. That's horrible. Like, that's... I mean, that's just straight up child abuse.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, no
and
matter.
She did that to my other siblings. But she fucking did that to me after knowing and like removing items from my body that my brother put in me while I bled and screamed. So when I was smaller, yes, she would pin me down. And honestly, my three younger brothers got the worst of it with the beatings. It's really tragic because I talked to at least two of them, the two older of the three younger brothers, when they were adults. And granted, this was like over 10 years ago, so I don't know what they think of it now. But they were both like, oh, Amanda, we deserved that. We deserved it. We were such bad kids. And I don't know if it's age and perspective, but I think my brothers were like kind of normal in terms of their behavior growing up in a traumatic environment, in a cult with abusive parents and chaos reigning supreme in the home. And like they fought and they weren't always well behaved, but like they could also be so sweet. And they also played to like, I mean, they would kill each other half the time and, and play the other half of the time. You know, they were, we called them the Three Musketeers. And like, I think they were just what you would expect of little boys in that environment.
I mean, that's how you describe it. And we're, as you're describing, that's what I'm kind of, that's kind of how I'm interpreting it. It's just, it sounds like they were acting like young boys and it was,
and then they were acting out about their environment. So I'm sure it wasn't like, okay, for instance, I have friends with little boys and they scream and run and blah, blah, blah. And that's just, you know, normal. And they create chaos and a mess. And they fight sometimes. And I think my brothers were like that, but just probably up a couple notches, which would account for the environment in which we were raised. Mm. Because, well, what I said to those two brothers was that what Chris did was abuse. And then they were like, oh, no, 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 no. She was such a good parent. Like, we deserved that. We were so bad. We were the worst. She was such a good mom. Like, we deserved that. And they both said that. Like, the way they talked about it, both of them, it was very, like, Stockholm syndrome-y. And it broke my heart at the time. It still makes me sad to think about it now. I hope they know now that, like, that wasn't normal. And I probably should have given a topic disclaimer earlier, but we're going to go a little bit deeper into violence. one of the worst fucking memories of my life. The house that we moved into when I was 11, it was like this old Victorian farmhouse and it had weird doors with like locks and keys, and you could lock the back half of the house off. So you walk in through the mudroom, into the kitchen, into the dining room, and then there were doors that you could lock so you couldn't get to the living rooms. You couldn't go upstairs to the bedrooms. Like, it just all got locked off. And one day, Chris lost her fucking mind. I don't know what the boys had done, but she had them lined up over a sofa, whipping them with the switch. And they were screaming, and I went running. I went running to find her, and I was like trying to pull her back and pull her off and like pull the switch out of her hand. And I got beat up pretty good and pushed into the dining room, and she locked all the doors. And then she kept beating them for a really long time while they screamed.
Wow, that's next, some next level. You know, like,
I couldn't get through the door.
Yeah. That sounds horrible.
And I think Amy was with me for that. And I think, like, we didn't have the best relationship, but I think we just stood in the dining room, like, holding each other and sobbing because we couldn't get in there.
Mm-hmm.
So then I decided that enough was enough after that. And she would hide the switch. She would bury it somewhere in the house. And so every time she went to the grocery store or out on errands, I would systematically hunt the house for it. And it took a while, but eventually I found it. And one of the perks of having to wear ankle-length skirts is you can hide stuff. So I got one of my skirts one day while she was gone. I went and got the switch. And I wore like a billowy t-shirt and one of my ankle-length skirts, and I tucked it into the band mm-hmm. of my skirt, like underneath. And I walked it out of our yard. We had an agreement with the neighbors that we could walk along the edge of their property into the area behind where there was like a meadow and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked all the way over there down to the end of that neighborhood where there was a, what are those? Culverts. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
a culvert. And I crawled into the culvert and hid it in there under some rocks. And then Chris ordered another one. And that kind of stuff, like, it just, I don't think Abby ever got beaten up. But my younger brothers did, and I did. I don't think the older three ever got the switch used on them. And Rick was different. Like, Rick would discipline, but he was like, that this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you.
Yeah.
And he didn't hit us hard. And like a lot of times if Rick was the one disciplining, it usually ended in something funny happening. Like I remember one time, this would have been, I don't remember how old I was, but my three younger brothers, they all got in trouble for something and they were sent to their room until Rick got home. And he was supposed to go in there and give them a spanking. And he walked in and they had all stuffed like books or they'd put on all their pants or something.
Yep. Put a couple extra pair of underwear on them.
Yeah. And Rick came walking out of their room like hunched over laughing. Like he couldn't even do the discipline because he was laughing so hard.
Got a pillow stuffed in their pants.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
So is that normal, like in the cult, for the
will breaking beatings?
Well, yeah.
The guy in the Shiny Happy People thing talked about that too.
I guess my question was it more prevalent for the wife or the mom to like be the hardcore discipliner as opposed to the father?
My only evidence for that is anecdotal. Like in my family, it was the guy in the docuseries talked about how his mother was in the Voller, like the lady who taught the blanket or the three times training. It seemed like she was the disciplinarian. And to train up a child, it seemed like Debbie Pearl had a lot more like disciplinary opportunities as the stay-at-home mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that was usually it. Like you had these stay-at-home mothers who became the primary caregiver. And I think anecdotally, therefore, the primary disciplinarian. And a lot of these women were like unhinged. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
A lot of the adults were pretty fucking unhinged.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously, we don't have the answer to this question. I'm just kind of curious, like, were the wives or the moms just like having so much repressed anger they couldn't get out any other way? It's just like, well, kids being a hellion. And so like, here comes all this rage that's inside from being oppressed and, you know, like overworked and all this other stuff. And they just,
I
like
mean,
take it
you
out
could,
on the kids.
But I feel like that's a very, slippery slope of like excusing the behavior, like, oh, their oppression resulted in abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was fucking oppressed my whole life and I'm not out there abusing people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you can, yes, you can be an oppressed person and be filled with rage and channel that rage into oppressing and harming other people. Or you can be oppressed and you can be like, I'm going to fucking get myself out of here. And then I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to help people not be oppressed. You have other options, or you can just walk away and like, you know, go live in Antarctica where you don't have to deal with humans and, you know, just live in peace for the rest of your days, mm-hmm. albeit cold. So you have options other than turning into a fucking maniac.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned on this podcast before, like I slept with a wire hanger under my pillow for years because of Chris's rage issues and her abuse of us. And I kept a go bag for myself and I kept a go bag for my younger siblings. And I memorized the route to our grandparents' house. And as we drove there, like even when we moved an hour and a half away, I would map out like, here's where we can walk and sleep and here's where the police stations are. And like,
wow.
Oh yeah. Like I
you're
was
ready.
Yes. I'm sure a lot of that was a trauma response,
mm-hmm.
but also she would lose her fucking mind. And
well, it sounds like you had plenty of reasons to come up with a plan like that. Like,
oh yeah,
sure. It's one thing to know like, oh, I know how to get to grandma's house. Like you go down here and you turn here and then you turn there and then you turn here and you're there. It's a different thing to be like, oh, here's where we can sleep on the side of the road.
Yes.
Like that's a whole other level of planning and, you know, just thinking.
And I don't know if
especially
my
as a kid.
Oh yeah. Like keep in mind this was all going on before I was even a teenager. Like I had the go bags and slept with a hanger, and I don't know if they would remember it, but like I would tell my younger brothers, like, I have a plan. If it gets bad, we're leaving. We're going to Pop and Grandma's. I'll get us there. Like,
did you get close to doing that?
Yeah.
After that instance.
Yeah. And part of my plan was our bedrooms were on the second floor, so we did have a fire escape ladder. And I think I remember, like, that was my plan. Like, I would get them out in the middle of the night, down the fire escape, and we would go. And I think I told them about it once.
The plan?
I told them that if it got bad, we were going to go out the window in the middle of the night using the fire escape ladder, and I would get us to the police or to Pop and Grandma's or something. And I don't know how my siblings experienced our childhood, because I'm not them. Mm-hmm. And again, the conversations I had about this were like over 10 years ago. And my impression at the time was like there was significant Stockholm syndrome. So I don't know if my siblings thought things were dire. I had the piece of the puzzle of like, oh, we get raped in this household too. Like,
extra.
Unsafe. Yeah. So I think I was more aware and alert to just the dynamics. And I mean, you know this now, like if your breathing changes, I notice it. Like yes, part of growing up in that environment was being hypervigilant. And part of my therapy work as an adult has been around coming out of hypervigilance, but I just monitored everything. Like, I monitored Chris's mood all fucking day long. And I would be like, all right, kids, we're going to go play outside, or, you know, whatever, because I knew she couldn't. Our house was on the corner of a pretty busy street, so I knew she couldn't walk out there and beat us.
Oh, like in public?
Yeah, in the yard. Mm-hmm. So if I kept the kids outside playing,
you're safe.
They were safe. Yeah. And we, like, before the switch, there was a 2x4.
Really?
Yeah.
That's brutal.
And then one time we were in the North Woods. We would go to this lake and not camp, but they had like log cabins along the lake. And they had boats you could take out, canoes, rowboats. And one year someone broke one of the oars, like just the handle.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to buy them a new one. And Rick took the broken oar home and used that to hit us.
Like the paddle, like the actual like paddle like part, actual or paddle the stick,
the oar, the okay. paddle. And then after the switch, it was just kind of like the switch. Yeah. And I don't know how long Chris continued to use that, because you know I eventually left for college and moved out. I feel like I got rid of the second switch too. I feel like I found a way to get that one out of the house, but I don't remember.
So was there ever a point in which like the switch was permanently gone because they gave up, that it kept getting stolen, or?
I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, I've mentioned this on the podcast as well. The last time I was hit in the face, and I was, I think 21. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it didn't really like stop. I don't remember Andrea getting hit that much. I think I saw her get hit in the face at least once. Andy rarely got punished for anything. I feel like Amy hardly got hit. I think I remember seeing her get maybe hit in the face once.
And did like any of the kids, once they had, you know, went past like 18, did any of them like stand up to the parents, or was it just everybody was kind of used to that? Like, you know, even
I don't know what the boys did. I don't know what the younger boys did. I feel like as we got older, we all fought her. Mm-hmm. And my thing was, I was quick. I was speedy. So I would run away. I would run up the stairs. I would throw the dresser in front of the door. I would brace against the bed, against the wall, and like slam my back into the door and brace with my feet in the bed frame to keep the door shut. And eventually she'd get sick of trying to get in and go away. Mm-hmm. But then you still had to stay in there for like hours and hours right, and hours. And like, God bless if you had to pee or something, like mm-hmm. you were just stuck. So I mostly ran away. I don't know if the boys fought her or not mm-hmm. as they grew up. I don't know.
But it sounds like the disciplining. I mean, it was abuse, but like the disciplining they were doing, it wasn't any different for the girls or the boys. It sounded like everybody kind of got the same.
I think the boys got it worse. I mean, I got hit in the face a lot. And maybe my brothers were a little dipshits sometimes. Like one of them pulled a knife on me a couple times, like a kitchen knife. Wow. The other one, stabbed me repeatedly with a pencil, like made holes in my arm that had like lead stuck in it from the pencil. And they hit me. My brothers would punch me. My younger brothers would punch me in the stomach a lot. So, I mean, they weren't always great, mm-hmm. but also they got lined up and beaten. So, again, I think it's age that's softened my opinion of their childhood antics a bit, and perspective and getting out of there. But I think the boys, the three younger boys, probably got it the worst of all of us in terms of like violent beatings numerous times. Many times.
So why do you think the youngest got it so bad?
The younger three?
Mm-hmm. Like, do you think had to do with Chris's like mental state at the time or just...
I think it was some of that. I think the girls were better at compliance because we were raised to comply. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the girls were better at compliance. The girls were better at being quiet. Unless it was something dumb and it was me, then I would say it was dumb. Yeah. And the boys, I don't know, they were just, they weren't, I mean, I don't know if any of us were parented. I don't know if the three older kids, like the three older than I am, got parented. I don't think I was ever parented. Like, I don't feel like anyone raised me. Probably the closest thing to that is Andrea, the oldest kid. And then the three younger boys and Abby, I feel like Amy and I did a lot more of that, like, nurturing, caring for, like, I don't have a lot of memories of Chris being a mom to them. Like when I was really little, I have memories of her coming in at bedtime and singing us songs and like rubbing, like I remember her stroking my hair. And I loved those moments. I loved them because she always said she didn't sing well, but I thought she had such a pretty voice. And I liked the song she sang, and I liked when she would sit there and stroke my forehead and my hair. But that stopped, like, young. Like, these are toddler-type memories. Mm-hmm. When the younger kids came along, it was like me and Amy and Andrea for a while. She was so much older, she was gone working at the cult headquarters. When a lot of the kids were young. So it was like, it was me, it was Amy who put the kids to bed. We were the ones who sang them the songs. We were the ones, like, I figured out, you know, my one brother, if I rubbed his eyebrows, he would fall asleep. You know, if I sang to him and rocked him and rubbed his eyebrows. There was another one. We had one of those braided rugs, you know, in a big oval, and I would just rock him and walk the whole pattern of the rug all the way in and all the way out until he fell asleep. Like with Abby, I think Chris was excited to have a girl after the three boys. I think she had wanted Abby to be a girl. So she was a little more involved. Like I remember her giving Abby baths and dressing her and doing her hair and stuff. Whereas like with the boys, I think Chris would give them haircuts, but like on Sunday mornings before church, on Wednesdays before prayer meeting, anytime we went anywhere, it was usually me and or Amy, you know, making sure that they had the right clothes to wear, making sure they took their shower or bath, making sure they combed their hair and brushed their teeth. Like I remember when we would go away on vacation or holidays, like I would be in my younger brother's room packing their backpacks with all of their outfits. And like, I don't know if they ever got parented by anyone other than their older siblings. And I think that that's like problematic. I don't know. People are like, oh, it must be so cool to grow up in a big family. And I really think it's not. Like, we didn't have access to the parents. When you're part of a large family, there's not enough time to go around. And Chris, for like 2 minutes, she did this thing where like she was going to spend an hour with each of us every week. Like we each had one day a week where we got an hour of Chris time. And I remember that happening like maybe three times. We did a tea party in the living room once. I think we went shopping together once. And like, I feel like there was another one, but it was very short lived. And I don't even know if my younger brothers and sister got that. That might have been done and over before they were even born. So I think where I was going with all of that was like, no wonder these kids acted out, the younger ones, you know, the way they did. I don't think, and Rick, oh God. So then the boys got into basketball, and Rick was that asshole parent who like needed to vicariously live through their child. And he would like, if they missed a shot or something, he would like go storming out of the gym and pacing the halls and all angry and yell at them the whole way home. And like, what a dick.
The very cliche, overly involved parent.
I don't know. Maybe it's the way my life circumstances have shaped me, but I cannot imagine looking at your child and being like, you little fucktard, you missed your free throw. Like, like what kind of asshole does that? Like, they're a little kid, for God's sake. NBA players miss that shit sometimes. Like, jeez. I don't know. So
was that just like a continuation of the perfectionism?
Oh God, yes. Because Lewis has had to be the best. I don't know if you knew that, Kyle, but you can't be the best because the Lewises have been the best since like the 90s.
So I think we've made it through the three times training, the pearls, the switch, the glue sticks,
and blanket training. We did that too.
So spirit breaking.
Yeah. So if you didn't break your child's spirit back when they were 6 months old, you know, Kyle, you really had your work cut out for you as a parent in the will breaking department.
So was that their like total objective was like, let's get them trained to be obedient like by 6 months so that we didn't have to like
continue doing this? Because the pearls differentiate between training and discipline. They say that discipline only occurs if you don't train properly. So training equals abuse, you know, with the pearl methodology. But yeah, their whole thing was to just eradicate free will, I think, from a young age. And like, there's this one horrible example of from the book of Debbie Pearl, like she wanted her kid to like this pair of skates or something, and he wouldn't like turn the skate over and roll it. So he was being defiant. So she switched him and told him to, you know, hold this gate and make the wheels spin. And he didn't. And so she switched him like 10 times before his defiance finally broke and he made the wheels on his skate spin because she told him to and he needed to honor authority and immediately obey. Like, can you imagine being such a petty bitch that that is the line you draw in the sand and die over?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to hold your skate upside down and spin the wheels with your hand or I'll beat you.
That's pretty bad. And I'm sure the kid was like defiantly not doing it because they're like,
oh, because they're like abused and yeah.
They're just like, no, I don't like, I'm just going to say no because it's. You're just trying to
That as a kid. It's almost, oh man, I don't know. I have really connected with dystopian stories as an adult because, you know, they're the rebels fighting for freedom and goodness and the cause. And then you have like the tyrannical evil, you know, mm-hmm. overlords. And I think that you get some of that. Like, that's at least the way I went. Like, I know the cult would say this was the worst thing because rebellion is the worst thing that you can have in your spirit as a person. But like, you gotta have a bit of that like rebellion in you to survive that environment. Like, you have to have that drive that's like, I'm gonna keep my head up if I'm hit. Mm-hmm. Like, if she hits me in the face, I'm not gonna cry. I'm gonna stand there and stare her down because she just hit me in the face. And Rick made me stand there and take it. So I'm just going to be a fucking ice queen. And like, you have to kind of have that to get through that environment. And, but if you had that, then you got targeted more too.
Of course.
So, you know, that defiance, I think that was like that spark of, like, human spirit mm-hmm. that was fighting back against this oppression and abuse. One of my other worst memories, actually wasn't being hit. It was I temporarily broke once. And this memory haunts me. I'm very ashamed of it. Because it's the only time I remember breaking like this. I was in college, so an adult, was over the age of 18, and I think it was summer break or something, and I was home, and Chris and Rick were in the process of trying to break my will again because there was a guy I wanted to date.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the guy I ended up marrying, which is a whole other story. I think in the divorce episode, I talked about how he was such a good friend growing up mm-hmm. and like was a good thing in my life.
Yeah.
And then we got married and then it all went bad. So like the relationship I was wanting and fighting for at the time was with someone who had only ever been good to me and supportive of me, and loving toward me. So it seemed like a pretty okay thing to like fight for, seeing as I was an adult, you know, providing for myself. Oh gosh, this means we need to talk about the concept of stay-at-home daughters.
Oh, jeez. Well, so you can save that one for another one. That sounds interesting.
Well, but you kind of have to understand though.
Okay.
So the cult wanted you to be a stay-at-home daughter until marriage. Like, you needed to get married out of your father's home. Like, okay, literally right. Live there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was supposed to be a stay-at-home daughter. So I'm like, I'm this adult. I'm living, you know, the whole school year. I provide for myself. I come home for the summers, for Christmas. You know, I buy my own food. I'm paying rent to live in their home, you know. But I have to be a stay-at-home daughter, you know. Get married out of
like a continuation of the transfer of authority.
Yes.
Like, you got to mm-hmm. be under Rick's authority. Until
yes. Yes. So that's why it was. And then, you know, the courtship commitment. And mm-hmm. Even though my ex and I never slept together before marriage or did anything untoward, which I don't recommend, by the way. it was still so rebellious of me to want that relationship. So they had pulled out all the stops. Like, I was having medical issues that I now know were from, childhood trauma, but they said it was from my rebellious spirit and God would keep punishing me and all of this stuff. And there was this one day, Chris was just going at me and yelling at me, and we were in the fucking laundry room of all places. We were in the laundry room off the kitchen of their home. And I couldn't take it anymore. Like, the screaming, the yelling, the hitting, the being told that God was cursing me and anything bad that had happened to me ever was a result of my rebellion and turning my back on my parents' authority. And keep in mind, I'm an adult in this scenario. And I finally just broke, and I was like, help me then. I sobbed it. I was like, help me. And then everything changed in her demeanor. And then she was just very calm and very quiet and very cruel. Like, it didn't fix that part. She just got like stone cold killer. And I was so ashamed of myself in that moment. Because I made it through my whole fucking childhood without doing that. And it didn't happen. I was very sick at the time too. Physically, I was not very strong because of everything that was going on with my body. And I think all of that played into it. But that was the only time I broke. And it didn't last super long. I think it took a couple of months for me to realize I got sucked into the bullshit that I had worked so hard. Cause that was the one period of my life where I tried to make the cult stuff work. So I had rejected it from a young age of this is bullshit. This is nonsense. This is illogical. This doesn't make any sense. What the fuck? I mean, I didn't know the word fuck back then, but you know what I mean? And I made it all the way through until I was mostly out of the house as an adult. And then just the psychological warfare that occurred at that point. Because I had started talking about the abuse and stuff. So they cracked down on me pretty hard in terms of trying to continue to control me. And yeah, for a couple months, I really tried to believe and buy into all the cult stuff. I think the whole rest of that school year into the summer. And then I had some friends who were you realize you're an adult and you can do what you want. And I was no, I don't realize that.
Did that click with you? Did that actually make a difference to you? And they were hey, you're legally, you don't have to answer to them anymore. Did that?
I mean, it took a while. It took months, probably actually years of those sorts of conversations. And then I started doing what I thought was the right thing before I was even ready to. That was the time in my life where I was okay, I'm going to move across the country and take a different job. And I'm going to do this and that to try to create space and distance. So even though I hadn't fully figured out my mental state, I knew I wasn't in a safe place and I knew I needed to get away. And so I started taking the steps to do that. And it was very scary. It was so scary. And I spent most of my time convinced that God was going to curse me for being rebellious.
So did that option feel different? So it sounds like you didn't believe the fact that you were an adult and you didn't have to listen to them anymore. But did the option of but I can take a job and move, and that is an option that I actually have, as opposed to just not listening to your parents. Was that, is that how that played out in your head? Or did it just play out like that?
There was some of both. I could not be in even the same town as them without them actively controlling me. Mm-hmm. Including my ability to drive places. So the job that I got across the country, it was as a caretaker for an older woman. It came with a place to live. It came with a car. Like, I had just gotten my driver's license finally. They'd finally allowed me to get my driver's license. I was 20, almost 21. And yeah, that it was like the only way out. And I don't know if I even gave them the address initially.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rick, eventually they started being kind of nicer to me. And Chris, when I left for that job, wrote me this long, weepy letter about how she'll always be my mother and love me so much. I burned that, by the way, because it was lies. And
true cult fashion.
And well, first I hung on to it for years because I wanted to believe it was true. And then I burned a lot of their stuff after I reported my brother and they proved once and for all who they are. So eventually it got like things got to the point where like I allowed Rick to have dinner with me when he happened to be in that area for work. And we went for a walk along the beach. And he said, you know, Amanda, I really wonder what you're going to think of this time in your life when you look back on it someday. Well, I have a great answer to that. Now that was like 16 years ago. Yeah, when I think about that time of my life, I'm like, fuck. I had to move across the country and move into someone's house to get away from them. They were fucking awful. How horrible that I had to move across the country to get away from my abusive family. That's what I think of that time in my life.
What was he trying to say?
That I would look back and realize how rebellious I was and, you know, that the family.
How far you'd fallen.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Didn't work out, Rick. Sorry about your problems, but also not sorry.
That's, wow. That's crazy.
So, lots of therapy. Mm-hmm. Lots of therapy. I feel bad for my ex-husband a little bit around this stuff because, like, we kissed and made out, you know, a bit before we got married, but, like, I had never lived with a man, you mm-hmm. know, like, cause we didn't live together and I was very jumpy. I was like very, very jumpy and he never hit me or like he was never physically violent toward me. But for months after we got married and he moved in with me, I would flinch anytime he walked up to me. If he like raised his arm to give me a hug, I would like, both of my arms would like go up in front of my face to block a hit. Like wow. I was pretty messed up.
So you were like still conditioned to like your home environment.
Yes. You know. Cause I wasn't like that in, for instance, my college dorm environment and mm-hmm. stuff. I think it was specifically home. And it was specifically there was a man in my home. And after I got married, and I, like back then I still was grappling with all the ideology, but like as per the cult, I was the property of my husband, not the property of Rick and Chris, mm-hmm. particularly Rick. So it was like having that release from being the property of Rick and Chris, like, unleashed all of the emotions that had been pent up and the fears and that took a minute. I've mentioned before that healing from the physical abuse was like the easiest part of the whole journey. And I stand by that to this day. I mean, I think it took less than 6 months and I had, you know, relaxed enough that I didn't go into a defense position if my ex tried to hug me or walked toward me. But that was a really rough transition that I wasn't expecting when I got married.
So you said you weren't expecting that. Like, what was going through your head when you, like, you get into this new environment where you're living with somebody else that's not your family, and then you start having these kind of reactions that you weren't expecting? Like, how did that?
Well, it wasn't cognitive at all. It was like bodily instinct. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't think, oh no, what if he hits me? It was like my body just interpreted someone moving toward me as I'm about to get hit.
It's like a natural reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a weird time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds horrible and probably very confusing to kind of live through and work through.
I'm trying to remember if I ever did therapy like specifically around the physical violence. I don't think I did. I think it just kind of like came up from time to time. And then I worked a lot of it out just not being hit mm-hmm. for an extended period of time until it kind of subsided. And I think naming stuff is really important. For me, at least, if I can identify like, wow, that was abusive. Blanket training is abusive. Hitting your 6-month-old with glue sticks is the dumbest shit I've ever heard. Like, that is so wrong. For me, for the way my brain works, for my personality, naming it and calling it out is very healing. It has a very powerful impact on me. So I feel like that's helped a lot over the last couple decades.
I'm sorry you had to go through all that.
Thanks.
There's a lot in there.
Zero stars, do not recommend.
Yeah. So I think the only thing we haven't touched on, or maybe we did enough, is the instant obedience.
Oh, yeah. I think with that, it's mostly just the conditioning that you have to do everything you're told,
mm-hmm.
and it completely removes agency and critical thinking. And having to regain that as an adult is a tedious process. And that having that mentality, like before you work through it and eradicate it, can put you in some very unsafe situations because you're so conditioned to just like take whatever happens from anyone who claims to be an authority over you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. So that was a rough one.
Figured I had a break there for a bit. We did a lot of funny and laughing and pondering the complexities of the universe. But yeah, people have been asking about that. So there you go. That's discipline in the cult.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I know that was very hard on you. And it takes a lot of courage to dig deep into those bad memories and, you know, share them.
Don't hit your kids, for the love of God. And if you have, like, say something about it to them, like go back, apologize. Let them see that you have remorse if you have behaved in an abusive way toward them. And if you struggle with rage, like,
find a different outlet.
Well, get help, you know? Yeah. Care about yourself enough to get help. Care about the people around you enough to get help. You don't have to live with rage. You can work through whatever is causing the rage. Mm-hmm. And move forward in a better way. And something that breaks my heart, I was having dinner with a friend recently, and she was like, her father had a stroke and it really changed his personality. And now he's like so sweet and kind. She was like, where was this man for the last however long? Those stories break my heart. Like the terrible parent, and then they're old, and then suddenly they're nice because they realize their time on Earth is limited in this life. And they're like, well, I guess I better start atoning for my sins. Like, don't wait. We don't have to wait. We do not have to wait until we're staring down death to make the changes necessary to be people folks will primarily have loving stories about, instead of getting on a podcast and talking about abuse as their memories of you. You know, there's still time to fix it. Fix it young if you can.
Well, thanks again for sharing all of that and talking us through discipline in the cult. I know that wasn't easy, and I'm sorry all that happened to you, and that's what you had to deal with.
Was a lot of that new to you?
I would say most of that was new.
How are you doing?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to see you go back and pull those memories out, because I know you've probably tucked them away in there, because they're not pleasant memories. So yeah, it's hard to see you go in there, but I know you're very courageous to, you know, say those things out loud, let alone, you know, on a podcast that's out there. So, you know, that takes a lot of courage and strength and bravery to, you know, even share that kind of stuff. So, just thanks for sharing.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And that wraps up our episode on discipline in the cult. And
thanks for listening. That was probably a tough one.
Yep.
Oh, we should tell folks. Speaking of thanks for listening, let me pull up the current stats. I think we have listeners in 54 countries now. Let me look.
She gets very excited about this.
I love stats, guys. Like, the numbers just make my soul sing.
She does. She's just like constantly looking at it. Like, it's not a bad thing. Like, she's just like, we must get listens. It's like she genuinely loves the numbers. It's like a nerdy mathematician over there is like, statistics are awesome.
It's so true. All right, so our current location count is 54 countries. Should we call out our top couple countries?
Sure.
Okay, so
I haven't looked at I don't look at the stats, so I'm not even sure what it is.
Missing all the beautiful numbers, Kyle. It's okay. I will look at the numbers for you. All right, so we're from the U.S., so obviously the U.S. is our largest listener base, but then Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Austria.
Wow.
Our top countries.
Was that the top 10?
Well, how many was that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah. And then should we just do a couple runner-ups for fun?
Mm-hmm.
Hello to Sweden, Austria, South Africa, Switzerland, Finland, Panama, Italy, Israel, Botswana, Belgium, Kenya, Poland, France. And then the list goes on and I won't read them all. But hi, everyone. Thanks so much for listening.
That's crazy.
I know.
We're going to have to go on a worldwide tour, just go visit all these places.
Yeah.
Just for fun.
Gosh, I would love to visit all these places.
We'll get there.
Well, if you want like extra homework, message us and tell us the best places to visit in your country, and we'll put it on our list. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We do like to travel, so I'm sure we'll get there.
We do. So thanks again for listening, everyone. And we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Cult I Left Behind.
Until next time, don't join a cult.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please like, share, and subscribe, and we will catch you on the next episode.